Welcome to episode 110 of Practical Defense. Recap of episodes 108 and 109. Welcome to the Practical Defense Podcast, where you'll learn practical approaches to staying safe in our increasingly dangerous urban environments. I'm your host, Alex Haddix. Whoo-wee! The past two episodes, numbers 108 and 109, have generated a ton of comments and email. So what I'm going to do this episode is share a few of the emails and cover some of the most common questions that I've received. I was originally going to call this a mailbag episode, but by the end it turned into more than that, so I'm going to call it a recap show. For those that may not remember or are still catching up, episode 108 was on common pitfalls with defensive weapon selection, and number 109 was a quick tip from Masad Ayoub on the reasons why you should not use public urinals. Before we jump into the mailbag, I have two quick points of interest. First, some good news. For those that listen all the way to the end of the show, know that for the past year or so, I have been writing a monthly online column for Taekwondo Times magazine called Raising Awareness. Well, the online column is going away. And it's a good thing, because my column is moving to the print edition of the magazine. So the last online article was posted January 2010. The next article will appear in the printed magazine, probably starting with the June edition. I'm really excited, and it should provide some really good exposure for the podcast. Next, with the earthquake tragedy in Haiti, there are a lot of scams out there claiming to be charitable organizations. Be careful in who you give to, and beware of any agency or organization that you've never heard of popping up out of nowhere and asking for money for the victims of the disaster. I receive bunches of new spam emails daily trying to capitalize on the suffering of others. It's really sickening stuff. Disregard these types of emails and go with the big providers that have a proven track record, like the Red Cross, which is my personal favorite, UNICEF, USAID, and Doctors Without Borders. I'll put links to these organizations in the show notes. Times are tough for everyone, but please try to give what you can. I'd also like to say that in all of my travels around the world, I have personally seen two relief organizations in action, the Red Cross and Doctors Without Borders. I've seen the Red Cross at work domestically and both the Red Cross and Doctors Without Borders internationally. They are both solid organizations that do a lot of fantastic work on the ground in the communities. And with that, we'll be right back with some emails and a look back at the past two episodes of Practical Defense.
Tom Gilmore lives on a farm. There's a storm on the way, so he's boarding up the windows of his house.
Haley Williams lives in an apartment. It's a beautiful day. She's making her usual monthly donation to the American Red Cross.
Tom doesn't know a tornado will leave his family with no place to go.
Haley doesn't know her gift will help give Tom's family shelter.
When you support the Red Cross, you change a life.
Starting with your own.
Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn about life-changing opportunities in your area.
Welcome back. Let's start off with some comments and items from Show 108, Defensive Weapon Selection. I'll read an email from Dave, who's in Massachusetts. Although I received a ton of emails, his is the best overall representation of most of the messages. He writes, "Hi, Alex. I just finished listening to episode 108. Great job and podcast." Well, thank you. "A few items regarding the selection of firearms for defensive weapon selection. First, on modification, I wanted your thoughts on changing sights. As an NRA and defensive shooting instructor, I see many students change their sights. I personally agree with that. As we know, a prosecutor will spin anything, but in this example, he wants to make sure he kills what he is shooting. But conversely, it could play to the defense of being a responsible gun owner, wanting to stop the attack and not wanting to risk collateral injuries. It can be a tough one. I personally carry a Glock that I've modified the trigger. While I know many have lightened the pull, I've added the New York trigger spring to make it a heavier pull. It also removes the take-up from the trigger that are on factory Glocks, reducing, I use reducing loosely, any nervous accidents under stress. Again, while a prosecutor can spin it any way they want, the defense can say he modeled his firearm after the New York PD. If the setup is good for the police to protect themselves, their families, and yours, it's acceptable for the defendant to protect him and his family. Likewise on the ammunition. Use what the police use, just like Mr. Ayoub writes in his book, The Gun Digest Book of Concealed Carry. While I read about an attorney, forgive me, I don't have the source, who successfully argued reasonable doubt regarding reloads because there was no baseline from which forensics could be made as in factory ammo, I agree, don't do it. Again, use factory ammo that the police use for the following reasons. 1. You can make the argument that if the police use it, there is merit in the ammo. 2. Factory ammo has been tested extensively and has real-world data behind it from shooting investigation. We can find what Federal or Remington ammo will do, but have no idea what Dave's reloads will do. 3. No matter how confident you are in your reloading skills, factory ammo is more reliable and consistent. Also, don't use full metal jacket or ball ammo. The risk is too high for overpenetrations and therefore hitting bystanders or property. Studies will show it takes more ball ammo to stop an assailant than it would for a jacketed hollow point. You can see where this can get a defendant in trouble on two counts. Shooting the assailant, say, 8 times rather than, say, 3 to stop them, and one or more bullets going through the assailant and into a house. As instructors and trainers, we give the best advice we can based on our knowledge, training, experience, research, and guidelines. Ultimately, it is the individual's decision on what they carry and how they are prepared to defend these choices. We hope they make the right ones. First, great email, Dave. Thanks for sending it in. You make a lot of great recommendations and bring up some really good points. Most of the emails I received about episode 108 were something like, what do you think about X? Where X is a particular modification, a type of firearm like a handgun, a shotgun, or a rifle, or what type of accessories would be okay? I'm not a lawyer, and I don't pretend to be one. The whole point of episode 108 was to get you thinking about the implications of what you carry and what you plan to use in self-defense before you use it. Considering the implications after the incident is too late. I'm not bringing up any secrets here. I'm just reminding you of your own common sense. These are merely suggestions and by no means guarantee that they will eliminate your legal woes. What they might do is help you avoid getting yourself into more trouble. These are simply trouble avoidance techniques. And you know, I am all about trouble avoidance. Let's look at the type of firearm first. The type, whether it's a handgun, a shotgun, or rifle, does not matter as much as how it looks or the reputation of the firearm. As I mentioned in episode 108, I would stay away from anything close to a Saturday Night Special since the media has branded that as a criminal's gun. I'd also stay away from anything like a Dirty Harry or Death Wish gun. Now, if you live in bear country, you might have a justification to have such a firearm on hand for self-protection. However, you're not likely to have a 1,200-pound grizzly walking through your yard in the suburbs of Atlanta, Georgia. Use common sense. Here's another example. I read somewhere, and I can't remember where, that Michael Bain keeps a 30-30 lever-action rifle at his bedside as a self-protection firearm because he would rather go to court with a John Wayne rifle than a tricked-out AR-15 or AK-47. Will they all work? Absolutely. But which one would look better in court? And that's the other key. Consider how the item looks. Now, this is completely subjective. There is no right or wrong. There are only degrees of better. And this is also where we get into some accessories. You must use your best judgment here. I know people like to swap out sights and triggers and install new optics and grips and lasers and sights and lights and collapsible stocks. If you choose to do it, be careful and don't overdo it. Going to court with a firearm that looks like something of Starship Troopers is probably not going to help your case. Moderation is the byword. The biggest point of contention in all the emails was about lasers and lights. You need to see and identify what you're shooting at, right? Here's how it was explained to me by one of my defensive shooting instructors. He told me, as a citizen, you're never going to be shooting in complete darkness. Your home will never be pitch black. You know your family. You know where they are and what they look like. You probably even know what they smell like and don't even realize it. An intruder will stick out. Using a light will unnecessarily ruin your night vision. If you want a light, by all means, use a secondary tactical light. I personally don't like pointing my firearm at someone to illuminate them. Some people say, well, you know, just point it at the ground and the light will bounce off the ground enough to see who they are. We can go back and forth on the light argument all day long. It's one of those items that has great points on both sides in any number of scenarios where the light is absolutely required and an equal number where they're not. It just comes down to preference. My preference? I love lights. I just don't have them mounted to my firearms. And again, I do not modify my defensive firearms. I find what I need already assembled by the manufacturer, and that's what I buy and use. And that goes for integrated lasers as well. A few people wrote in with suggestions about normal items that can double as defensive weapons, like tactical flashlights. Here's an example email from Miles. He didn't say where he was from. He writes, Alex, you talked about flashlights being used as innocent weapons. I carry the F701 stainless steel pen made by Zebra. I've tested it in two ways using my full strength. One, stabbing a pine 2x3 stud, and two, executing a wrist lock on the same stud. The pen still works and seems to perform effectively for a $10 item from the local department store. What are your thoughts? Thanks for your email, Miles. I agree completely. A good, solid pen can be used in a manner similar to a Kubaton or as a piercing weapon. And in fact, Jim Wagner has an entire chapter dedicated to this subject in his new book, Protecting Others. He even has pictures of normal items that can be purchased in airport gift shops that are long, hard, and heavy with sharp points that are perfectly legal to carry on to any plane in the world. The book will have pictures of Jim standing there, holding items he personally purchased in airport gift shops from all over the world. Things like a 3-foot or 1 meter long wooden pencil and a 2-foot solid iron miniature statue of the Eiffel Tower. These are nice mementos, but in the hands of someone trained and a bit creative, they could be used as defensive weapons if it came down to it. Way back in the first few episodes of the show, I did a series on travel safety, and I brought up pens and even recommended some Fisher Space pens because they have steel or even titanium bodies and are useful because you can ride at any angle, which is unbelievably handy when filling out custom forms while standing in line. Since that episode, nearly 2 years ago, a couple of companies have produced pens with a dual purpose of being defensive weapons. Cold Steel has produced a pen called the Sharky. It's a play on words with the Sharpie markers. Here's the product description, and I quote. As a saying goes, the pen is mightier than the sword. Indeed, Cold Steel makes some mighty strong swords, but this little pen makes for some clever competition. It's the biggest, baddest permanent marker around. Superficially, it shares many features common to most markers, but appearances can be deceptive. For starters, it's made from the glass-reinforced plastic, Grivery, the same tough material we use in our Nightshade series, and features walls that are 4 times thicker than similar markers. This means it's built for impact, and in a self-defense emergency, it can become an efficient Yawara stick for driving off an attacker. Plus, the screw-top cap will stay in place and won't pop off like a regular marker's cap would when you strike a percussion blow, or when obtaining joint locks or submission holds. Now, this sounds like a great tool, but the product description makes me hesitate. If they'd simply described the item and the features and left the consumer to make the connection, I would give it my full recommendation. Here's some things that make me hesitate. Phrases like, appearances can be deceptive. It's the biggest, baddest permanent marker around. Superficially, it shares many features common to most markers. It's built for impact. Won't pop off like a regular marker's cap when you strike a percussion blow. They make it sound so cool, but it could play badly for you in court. I mean, holy cow, they even say it superficially shares features. Shares features? Superficially? So it superficially shares features with most markers, suggests that it isn't a marker at all, but a weapon disguised as a marker. By its own description, this is a weapon first and a marker second. So the accusation could be leveled that you purposefully carried a hidden and disguised weapon to lure the poor victim into attacking you. You were looking for an excuse to beat someone up the entire time. You are the criminal, and the poor defendant is actually the innocent victim. Okay, you might be saying, now Alex, you're just nitpicking. Hey, guess what? Reality check. That's what attorneys do. Here's an example of a description done correctly. It's for the Surefire pen, the same folks who make some of the best tactical flashlights. The Surefire pen is a new addition to the ever-growing Surefire family, and it fits in perfectly. It boasts a rugged, aerospace-grade aluminum body that's mil-spec Type 3 hard anodized like many of its brothers, and it's perfectly balanced for writing. This bold, retractable Surefire pen is appointed with virtually indestructible, tumble-polished stainless steel on the tip, pocket clip, and the tail cap, which features a smooth, rounded window breaker that's always ready for emergency use and won't snag on clothing. And it writes like a dream. The Surefire pen comes standard with high-performance Schmidt Technology EasyFlow ink cartridge, which is all about performance, but the pen is fully adjustable too. You can use nearly any ink cartridge between 3.875 and 4.25 inches long with a simple adjustment. Smooth writing performance, elegant yet bold design, and it breaks glass in an emergency. What more could you want from this latest member of the Surefire family? Do you see the difference in the descriptions? Let's look closely at the features. Rugged aerospace-grade aluminum body that's mil-spec Type 3 hard anodized. Virtually indestructible tumble-polished stainless steel on the tip. Rounded window breaker that's always ready for emergency use. That sounds like a great defensive weapon without sounding like a defensive weapon. They also keep going back to the aspects of it being a pen first. It's perfectly balanced for writing. It writes like a dream. Easy flow ink cartridge. Smooth writing performance. Now, when you're standing in court, which product description would you prefer to have? So those are some examples of what I'm talking about when it comes to product descriptions. Attorneys are paid to pick apart the details and magnify what they want the judge and jury to hear. It's their job, and they do it every day. Don't hand the material to use against you if it can be avoided. All right, we'll switch gears here to episode 109, affectionately referred to as the P Podcast. I'll read one email. It's from my good friend Paul Wilson over at the Karate Cafe Podcast. Paul's also been on the show a few times. He writes, "There are some things I think your source overlooks. Personally, when I use the loo, I try to check the stalls, especially in sketchy environments and in smaller rooms. I try to take the last urinal in line and then change my angle so I'm almost at a 45-degree orientation. As intimated, if I'm off somewhere I'm worried about, I switch hands. Too much information? Or I use the hand farthest from the door. The moment someone becomes a threat, I can face him a bit quicker, plus they're getting wet. Folks have a propensity not to like getting peed on. That may slow them down. The urinal choice gives me the ability to immediately guard my back from attack. On the stall issue, it may not be politically correct, but I usually try and use the handicap accessible stall for reasons that I think address a tactical blind spot in the source's plans. One, they're bigger. This helps reduce attacks from below, sweeping and pulling the legs, and above, blunt force, pepper spray, etc. Two, most handicap accessible stalls also open out, while most regular stalls open in. The door lock on both is weak, but the handle pulling out might give before the latch does. You can put more muscle behind a kick or a shove than the pull as well. Note that someone pushing the door mid-pee will do as much as the same as a palm heel scenario in the episode. It will disrupt balance, and while it also limits the options of the attackers, it can tie the defender up, as well as putting the defender at the bottom of a pile of bad guys. 3. They usually have a bar on the wall that can let you vault out of there kung fu style. Also, you should note if the stall faces mirrors. coming out of the stall blindly opens you to being jumped from either side. Awareness, being the first level of defense, brings this one. Depending upon the environment, most people come in, do the deed, and split. If you're in there and the door opens and closes and it's quiet immediately after, my radar kicks in. Well, sonar, actually. The person may have changed their mind, etc., but I give a few seconds of dedicated listening for footsteps or breathing. Bathrooms usually have great acoustics for hearing small sounds as well as eavesdropping. I'm talking to you too, dude, on the cell phone. It's rude and stupid. Now, in a follow-up mail, Paul added, I went over the bathroom concepts last night. My students thought I was nuts at first, or nuttier than usual, but kind of got into it as we talked. And I think we'll close with those words from our pal, Nutcase Paul.
Gun Rights Radio Network has the best pro-Second Amendment, pro-gun rights podcast available on the net. The podcasts are absolutely free when subscribing using iTunes or Zune Marketplace. Or if you want, you can just listen from the website. Make sure you visit gunrightsradio.com to subscribe. Podcasting freedom, one episode at a time.
Since this was a mailbag-ish episode, there's no summary this week. And so that does it. Again, I really appreciate all of the great comments I've received, not just in the past few weeks, but over the past few years. Now, this is normally the point where I remind you to check out my online column with Taekwondo Times Magazine. But since the column is moving to the print edition, you can only find older articles there now. If you have any tips you'd like to share with everyone, a comment on a show, or if you would like to suggest a topic for an upcoming episode, write into podcast@alexaddicts.com. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, stay aware, stay safe. Practical Offense is a member of the Gun Rights Radio Network at gunrightsradio.com. And that does it for this episode. Thank you for downloading and listening to the Practical Defense Podcast. For questions, commentary, and topic suggestions, send an email to podcast@alexaddicts.com. That's podcast@alexaddicts.com. And if you ever want to train with me, look me up on the web at alexaddicts.com.